Welcome to the Digital Agency Growth Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Englander. Today's episode is sponsored by our company, Sales Schema, and we are a fractional new business team for marketing agencies and related marketing service companies. Even if you're not at the point of being able to hire a company like ours, I still want to do my best to help out. And today we are giving away access to our most recent recorded video training titled Relationship-Driven New Business at Scale, emphasis on at scale. This is all about how we secure 5 to 20 weekly brand agency relationships for each one of our clients using tasteful email outreach centered on personal and or business commonalities. A few things we cover. We cover the two big shifts that have created a huge need for this approach and why we think you should rethink the way your agency builds relationships and does new business. We cover the specifics on dozens of commonalities that we have used successfully to build relationships between agencies and brand side decision makers. We cover a simple follow-up process that you can use for your team, even if you're busy, even if you're in a mixed role between sales and client service. And we cover actual copy examples that you can use to get inspired and build your own campaigns. So if you'd like to get access to the video training, which runs about 30 minutes or so, you can do that by going to salesschema.com/relationships. Again, salesschema.com/relationships, plural. So this week on the podcast, we're going to switch things up a little bit and put the spotlight on our clients. And with today's guest, I think that we couldn't pick a better place to start this client spotlight series. So if you're an owner or an executive in an agency and you're kind of struggling to get out of the weeds of the day-to-day operations so that you can build more of a hands-off asset, either so you can have more time or kind of graduate to higher level leadership stuff, then I think you're going to get a whole lot out of this episode. So in this particular episode, we're very excited to welcome Farisa Knox, who is the founder and CEO of RLM Media. For background, RLM is a Chicago-based media buying agency and holding company established in 2008. They specialize on healthcare, political campaigns, recruitment, and some consumer spaces, but they really have a specialization on high compliance areas like healthcare. In addition, Farisa is the author of Love, Sex, and Friendship in No Particular Order, and she produced the miniseries PR Girl. So for context, if you're a casual listener, we work with RLM in a fractional new business role, helping Farisa tee up new relationships and meetings. This is not just a plug for us, but in addition to everything else, Farisa is going to go into how she's been able to get 2 to 3x ROI in around 5 months of working together. Beyond that, she talks a lot about how she's going about replacing herself in her agency. She talks about the value of starting with a research foundation in terms of what she's doing for her clients. So starting with research as a service, then using that to expand out to other things. She talks about the moat and the strength of focusing on sort of hard to work with, high compliance, pandemic proof areas. And she really usefully, she goes over her exact relationship-driven new business process, which often starts with the relationships that we've been able to get her. So without further ado, please give it up for Farisa Knox. Farisa, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So first, to start things out, you've had an interesting journey. You know, you've written a book. So I'd love to just kind of start with what did you have to go through to get to the point of founding RLM? What were those experiences like?
Yeah. So it's funny. I'm not one of those entrepreneurs who always was like, oh, I can't wait to start a business. Like, that's what I want to do. I tripped into knowing that this is something that I'm good at. And I think it just had a lot to do with the time and like where I was in my career and where we were, honestly, as a society. So in 2008, when the economy was crashing and Obama was becoming president, and you were feeling like that shift of change in the air, both socially and from a business perspective, it just made sense for me at the time because I was working at a place that was going bankrupt and they were being very honest with the employees. And I was like, oh, I need to go find my dream job. Like, I think this is the time for me to go do that. And in that mental journey of trying to figure out what that was, it was actually my now husband, then fiance, who was like, why don't you just reach out to some of your clients and see if they will use you for pulling together, you know, media plans and that kind of thing. And enough of them said yes, where it was just one of those adventures. It was just meant to be a life adventure until I figured out what my dream job was. And then fast forward 13 years, here I am still running my ad agency. It's grown a bunch since then in different ways. And, you know, finding ways to be creative and create other business ventures and things on the side.
Yeah, that's great. And it reminds me so much of my experience, because I remember finally landing in a job that I liked, and it was good lifestyle, interesting product I was selling. And still it was just like, I don't really like want to have to answer to a boss and all that. And I want to, you know, go my own way, and realize that it wasn't going to get better from that point. And then quit. And now I have 15 bosses, which is interesting. Right. In the form of clients, as you might as well. So that's always interesting. But in the early days, it was, you know, sort of not convincing former clients, but people in my network to, you know, hire me to consult and all that sort of thing. So you have to start somewhere. So anyway, you know, starting in 2008, some time's passed since then. What have you seen change in the media space, and what's sort of surprised or not surprised you so far?
Wow. Yeah. Well, back then, people were saying things like TV is king, and you know, radio and broadcasts are the most, you know, broad reach mediums. And in some cases, those things are still true. But as we all know, you know, we've evolved, technology has evolved, and, you know, digital was just starting to become something very significant back then, where, like most things that are significant, people were trying to figure out, how is this going to change consumer behavior, right? Where the original conversation was as if we were all going to stop watching TV, stop listening to the radio, terrestrial radio, and all of that, and just pivot all to digital. There were arguments on both sides. And what wound up happening is that we as consumers just started to diversify our time. Right. So, you know, depending on where you live in the country and how you navigate your day, how urban of a city you live in, folks have just added digital components into their life instead of, you know, some folks have cut the cord completely. But again, that's more of a life phase than an overhaul of your how you live your life decision. So now it's thinking of the consumer on their day journey, right? So if you wake up in the morning, you're maybe consuming your news in one fashion. You're looking at the weather and traffic in another, depending on where you live. Then you're at work listening or consuming in one way, right? But throughout the day, you're touching multiple mediums and in different ways, engaging with them in different ways. And so as a marketer and as an ad agency that got our start in media and now we're full service, we just have to understand that we have more options now as consumers. And really the key is understanding how the consumer engages with the medium and not if the consumer is using the medium, because we're using everything. And in some cases, multiple things at the same time, where my kids can be on their iPads watching something on TV at the same time. And it's like, it's a lot, but it's true. It's real. That's where we're at.
Yeah. That makes sense. So kind of moving from just a few mediums to many mediums and complex, you know, consumer journeys and everything. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what services you were selling at the beginning versus now, and, you know, as tangible as you can get, like what I'm curious, like what did you try? What worked, what didn't work, and so on those years, 10 plus years now. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we got started, we were just doing the media planning and buying and maybe a little strategy from a media perspective. And as we grew and really as our clients started to grow and sophisticate, we followed what their needs were. So from the media, the need immediately became creative. So we started figuring out how can we help our clients who are in the market for buying ad, you know, airspace anyway, create good pieces of content to put in that space. So started partnering with folks and ultimately created our own creative department where now we can do that in-house and service our clients from the strategy portion of it all the way through to production and execution and getting that out into the right places. From there, it started to become important that we could do research and really understand from a consumer or customer perspective what their needs are, how they might already feel about a product, what some of the missing pieces might be, and then use those insights from the research to dictate the direction of the creative. So then we created a research department, and now we're able to do research and consumer insights and really pull those together for our clients. And then most, like most agency and just, you know, marketing people know, once you have all of that moving, you need an accounts team. Like you need people to kind of keep all that glue together and have those cross department conversations happen. So we have that in place now. And then digital marketing services is our newest department where now we can really focus and hone in on smart strategic SEO and website development and production and obviously paid digital media goes along with that. So today we're all of those departments under one umbrella, really working in an integrated fashion to make sure that we're pulling the pieces that each individual client needs and not just saying like, here's your food, right? It's like, well, what do you like to eat? What do you need for your diet? And like giving them the ingredients that make sense for what they tell us their goals are.
Yeah. And that must have been an incredible journey building up all of those complex departments. So I'd love to hear kind of a little bit more on how you went about that. Like for example, how did you decide who to hire when, what, you know, how do you think about those sorts of roles and the people?
Yeah, I think in the 13 years of owning my business, this phase has been the hardest, like this growth phase that we're in now, because it's everything that you just asked. It's how do you know what department to focus on from a talent perspective, who to hire, when to hire. So the way I went about it, honestly, was starting with as the owner of the agency, who's also the CEO, how can I replace myself in as many situations as possible, right? To get out of a lot of the day-to-day client work and a lot of the day-to-day management work of the team. So I started there and looked at, well, what am I doing with my time besides running the business? And a lot of it was client relations. So I, in essence, was our first account director. I was an account director and a CEO at the same time and a CFO at the same time. And that clearly is not a smart strategic move, right? So I said, I need someone really strong in account management. Started there because I knew that the business would be able to pay for that role because of the work that we were doing and build that out as really important because it took something off of my desk. From there, with really strong account management help on our team, that woman came with a lot of research ability too. Like she was an award-winning researcher that I was able to onboard. So I was like, okay. With that skill set, and that wasn't on, you know, by accident, I really put out, and this might sound very like university, like I'm a universe feeler and believer in the power of like positive thinking. So I really put it out there into the universe that I wanted a woman who had, you know, a skill that I didn't possess because I didn't come from research and insights and consumer behavior, right? So she had to have something that I didn't have. But also be able to jump right in and take, you know, take the lead on some things. And so when I met Kristen, who's she had all of those things that I was looking for. And we worked really well together and onboarded her. So then with her came the research ability. So then that was the second piece that we leaned into. And then we waited last to do the creative because that's the order in which clients need all those things to happen, right? Like you need someone really smart and strategic who can help you win and close business. You need to start with smart thinking and research and what those insights mean from there. And then you have to go to creative. So I kind of went in the order that the client typically spends money in a hiring and a talent acquisition perspective. And then found folks that, first of all, met the RLM way and method and language and how we like to show up in the world. But then also that I love people who have like a slight entrepreneur spirit to them. Like they don't have to be entrepreneurs, obviously, but folks who understand the work and energy it takes to get, you know, a business from being in the corner of your living room to almost 20 folks today, and how to be a real asset and value add in some situations beyond just what you do for a living for our clients. And so that's how I look at talent, and that's how I look at where they need to go and live based on the journey of our customer and where our customers are spending dollars with us.
Yeah, and that's really important. There's so much to dig into there. I think the entrepreneurial hire angle is interesting because in the early days here, we would sometimes be like skeptical of hiring entrepreneurial people that have lots of side projects because we're like, are they going to get off course? But more recently, you know, we've given that up because we're like, that's just the price you have to pay is that good entrepreneurial people are going to have their own things going on. Mm-hmm. So that's a really key point. And it sounds like you guys kind of took an interesting approach where you started with research because that's the way that clients are doing everything anyway, as opposed to just arbitrarily saying, hey, let us rebuild your site or whatever, build this or that campaign, which is a really good way to do it. With that, you know, I know because we're working together that you guys are going after some interesting verticals, you know, high compliance areas, healthcare, higher ed, recruitment, finance, political. How did those come to be? How did you guys kind of hone in on these complex areas, basically?
Yeah. I wish I had like a sexier, better story to like answer that question. But in reality, those client categories came to be because of just where I had my personal relationships. So folks that I know here in Chicago and throughout the rest of the Midwest happen to have businesses or build businesses that fall in like the healthcare space, or we were responding to statewide RFPs that fell into the higher ed space. So that allowed us to take those two experiences and go after some more higher ed and healthcare opportunities. We've have a longstanding partnership with one of the top recruitment ad agencies in the country. They just happen to be here in a suburb of Chicago, and we've been working with them. And honestly, before I started my company, I was one of their account executives at the place I used to work and transitioned that relationship over. And then just being a woman-owned and Black-owned ad agency, we have our MBE and WBE certifications. And what that allowed me to do was really be a value add to some of these prime agencies as they're responding to government contracts, so that they can, you know, win the contract and then spend the money legally the way that, whether it's the state or the city, or in our case, sometimes county, Cook County, dictates how the money should be spent. And a lot of times, if not all the time, 20 to let's say 30% of it needs to be spent with a minority-owned business. So being one of the most modern ones that exists here in the state, we wind up working with a lot of folks in that vein. And then from a political perspective, I was lucky as an employee of the firm that I worked for before to work really closely on Obama's first campaign from a national radio perspective as he was reaching all of his multicultural voters back in 08. So all of that experience and relationships combined is what got us to those client categories that you mentioned. But we hadn't become purposeful about mentioning them and saying that this is what RLM does and who we focus on and who we service until honestly right up during COVID, because it was at the height of 2020 when we were all like still kind of like, oh my God, what's going on with the world, that I saw my agency not bleeding out. And compared to some of my counterparts, I was like, well, I'm happy, right? Like, thank God. But why? Like, why aren't we bleeding out? Why am I able to survive this the craziest time that we have all lived through personally and from a business perspective. And it was really those client categories. When I sat down and looked at what was going on, we were not only like surviving, we were on a bubble of about to thrive. And it was because these client categories, now I know, they're pretty pandemic proof. Like when we're all going through a global healthcare crisis, healthcare becomes the number one thing on people's minds, right? So before COVID, folks were still trying to figure out Medicare and Medicaid and how to get the people who live in their state vaccinated for the flu, right? So now, because RLM had all that experience, when it came time to talk about getting tested for COVID, in which the messaging then evolved into getting vaccinated for COVID, we were tapped on the shoulder because we came with a lot of healthcare experience. Same thing from a recruitment perspective. Your job, your money, and your health are things that never, ever get to disappear, no matter what we're going through as a society. And so because of that, once I realized that, I was like, oh my goodness, okay, well, this needs to be talked about on purpose now and not just like a thing that happens to be like when I tell people, oh, our experience is in this, this, and this. I always used to joke that we don't have like the sexy, like, soda companies or fast food or fashion, like some of the stuff traditionally that ad agencies really want, that wind up spending a ton of money annually. But, you know, they all, you know, McDonald's didn't have to spend as much money in 2020 as they do in normal years. Right. So what we found was some of these categories increased, and that's what really allowed us to thrive through 2020 and into 2021.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like it was the right move, kind of focusing on these robust, you know, almost timeless areas. With that, you know, one thing that we hear sometimes from agency owners is like, we really don't want to specialize or focus on one or a few similar areas. Like, what if our creatives get really bored? Like, they're always looking for the next new thing. So I'm curious, like, have you encountered that problem with your creatives where they're like, another banking site? Like, I don't want to do that. And if so, how have you kept things fresh, or if that's even the way you're thinking about it?
Yeah. To be honest with you, when people talk like that, the owner's hat comes on and I go, I don't care. Like, I don't care about your personal, feelings about a specific category or a client or any of that, because, first of all, because I try to find ways and then employ my directors to find ways to make the process of creation still fun and still feel like, for especially the creatives, that they are creating something that they feel is art, right? So I try to understand people's personal currencies and then use those to, you know, push them in the direction of the work that aligns with their personal currency. I've actually had this conversation internally with some folks in my media department around some of the work that we do and how it's just not, you know, maybe one person won't want to do this their whole time because it's not so much fun. I'm like, but that not so much fun equals $2 million in gross revenue for the business. So if they don't understand how important that is to the business and therefore themselves and their paycheck ultimately, and they might not be the right person to work here, because I don't want to spend any time convincing an employee that business that represents that much revenue, that's not, you know, like dangerous to anyone. It's not, you know, morally corrupt. It's not any of these things. It's just not as sexy as like a sneaker company. Then maybe this is not the right place for you. But you know, but with that, you still get, and when we do our jobs right as leaders and directors, our teams should still get the feeling of creating art, creating these things, because I tell my, especially my creative director, I'm like, you should give the instruction within a boundary so that there still feels like wiggle room to play around with, but there's clear boundaries in it, specifically for the creative folks, right? Because we/they, like we need room to feel like we're breathing and growing and doing, but we're still making, you know, ads for clients at the end of the day. So we have to do it within a parameter that makes sense for the brand, that makes sense for the platform it's going on, and has a call to action so that we get the results that, you know, we and our clients need to move the needle so that we keep the client. So ultimately, yeah. I'm like, I don't care, but I care, but I don't care.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. And what might be sacrificed with sort of like superficial sexiness, you know, is kind of made up for in meaningfulness. Like if you're shopping for open heart surgery, like with a hospital, that's different than buying a pair of Nikes, obviously. So right. the impact is way bigger. And with that, you know, you talked a bit about personal currency and that sort of thing. And you're in a position of getting things off your plate and kind of in a more mature phase of running an agency. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Like, what are the things that you would ideally like to be doing, you know, 100% of, like, where, you know, the superpower question versus what are the things that are you're working to get off your plate right now?
Yeah. I love that question. So the things that I would love to just exclusively be spending my time on as the CEO of the company is just long-term strategy building from an internal perspective, right? Like, giving my directors and the managers at my company the ingredients for them to go do their jobs amazingly, right? So if a department needs additional talent, if they need to figure out a software to use that will help from a project management perspective, allowing them the freedom and the space to go figure out what the needs are of their specific department and their pillar of the business. Thinking about how we show up in the world too, where, you know, it's crazy that it's the end of June where I feel like we just created a capabilities deck that was going to take us through this year. It's already expired. Like we have to now recreate that. So for me, if I could solely be focused on building the future, but nurturing the present, that is what I feel like is the best time I can spend focusing on RLM, and just making sure she, because like RLM is definitely a woman, feels like she has everything that she needs to grow and evolve, whether that's talent or, you know, anything else. Right now, honestly, I'm at the best place that I have been as it pertains to that. Also new business, like obviously, I think that not every CEO or owner is necessarily the person who should be in charge of new business. But when you know your strengths and you know what the rest of your team are working on, in some cases, I think it's appropriate. And right now for us, I'm the manager of our new business process working with you guys because I'm a salesperson. Like I'm a good salesperson and people who are know that they are. And right now, I have one or two other people who could also be really good salespeople for the agency, but that's not their job today. Right. So I have to transition that over eventually, but right now it makes the most sense that it sits with me. Same thing with the financial running of the business day to day. That's something that in a perfect world, I'm not touching come 2022. That needs to live with somebody else. But right now it makes sense that I do that. So those two things, new business and like financial running of the business, are the two items that next year will be the last two things that need to come off my plate.
Yeah. And that sounds like a good way to do it. And the way that you're thinking like that's the right way. Cause you know, every agency that's scaled, eventually the owners are getting off the new business off their plates, but it takes time and thinking and all that. So talking about new business a little bit, I'd love to hear, you know, what historically, I think you talked about referrals, but before we started working together, how are you typically bringing in new business and keeping the pipeline full?
Yeah. So it was a combination really of responding to RFPs, both as either a sub to a prime who needed or wanted a minority or woman-owned agency as a partner, or one that didn't have specifically media buying or planning capabilities in-house. And then we graduated to responding to RFPs as a prime, because as we became more and more full service and had more experience working on contracts, we were able to respond as a prime and win the business in full. And then it was icing on the cake that we were a woman-owned, minority-owned business. And then just relationships. Like before COVID, I was like on an endless tour, if you will, of like just being out in these streets, as I call it, like literally just networking. Networking for me is not like even a thing. It's just the way that I live my life, where if I'm at an event and I'm doing something or speaking on a panel or whatever it might be, some of the board work that I do, I'm always just presenting as who I am, which is the owner and CEO of a full service ad agency. And so because of that, I think my ears are always open for opportunity, whether it's to partner or to get a new client or whatever it might be. So for the first like 11, 12 years of the business, we were just resting on my ability to network and be social and engaging with decision makers and business leaders here in Chicago, responding to RFPs and partnerships and word of mouth, you know, because you do it well enough, clients talk to each other and then we get the referrals, as you mentioned. But with my plan to replace me and grow the business and make sure that at a certain point, I have something of value that if I want, I can sell. It became very evident that I was going to have to take our new business approach to the next level and really go after some heavy hitters and some contracts and value that could raise the bar of where we were before. Again, but not having internally the capacity to handle that like we thought we would before COVID. We were like, oh, we'll just create like this new business team and like the directors will run your department, but you'll also work in tandem with me to go find new business. And like months and months went by and we hadn't touched it because we had no time to do it. And that's when I started my search and found you guys.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And with that, what was it that sort of, you know, sealed the deal for us specifically, but also I guess first for an outside team in general and then with us?
Yeah. So it's funny, I am a part of a CEO peer group called Vistage. And I'm sure some of the folks listening probably are familiar with it. And in my Vistage group here in Chicago, one of my group members was looking at just an outside sales group for his business. He does something different than what we do, but he was looking and he bought that into our group to discuss the benefits of it, maybe some of the cons of it, what this other company was quoting him, and just having us help him work through, is this a good decision for my business? And working that through, I was like, huh, maybe I should go find one of those because it makes sense. And then for me, though, I wanted to, like, I'm all about erasing as much like questionable doubt that could be, right? Any item that could be a burden or a hurdle to this. So when I was looking, I specifically, and I didn't know even if it existed, but wanted an outside sales team that understood the agency world. Because as we all know, that's something very different than trying to find, you know, a good salesperson to help you sell widgets, right? Like that's a very different mindset, even from a services perspective. You know, consulting is very different than what a full service ad agency does. So like most things, I was just very specific about what I wanted. And then what sealed the deal with you guys was first and foremost, that is your, you know, your dedication. It's like, you're not doing this for literally every single type of company. you're doing it for marketing companies and for ad firms. And so that's really what allowed me to trust, I think, the process. And then I think the last thing I'll say on that is what I like is the strategy, right? Because yes, you know, like I said, all good salespeople know good salespeople, and you guys are that. But if there's no strategy against it, then it doesn't matter, right? If it's a good salesperson talking or curating communication, you need a strategy behind it. So the different strategies that we've been able to build and work along with you guys is really what continues to be the winning factor for me.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for that. And if you were, you know, setting up another agency for success, or even the new salesperson that you're going to be transitioning to in the next 1 to 2 years, what would you tell that person for getting the best results from, you know, a program like ours at this point?
That's a great question. I think that, first of all, it starts with understanding what needs to be communicated to people for them to react to your message, right? So I now, having been with you guys 6 or so months, like I can see in someone's response what resonated with them in the message that we sent them, right? So really being on the sales cycle from the beginning, from a relationship building perspective, right? I don't enter any of the new business calls that I'm able to schedule with any preconceived notion in mind of what they're going to need or what I'm trying to sell them. It's really about collecting that information to understand what their needs are, what their desires are, what might be lacking in who they might be using now, or what their internal process is, and then showing them the value that you bring to the table based on what their needs are. But that's really an integrated approach. And that's one that I think RLM has the privilege of approaching new business with. And I know not everyone does, but as integrated and individual item on a menu as you can be, I think that is the best approach that I found works with potential new clients, because you don't know. It's like going on a date. It's like going on a blind date. You don't want to go in saying like, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that. It's like you are there to learn about the person, right? And then give some information about yourself based on what they've said. So that's how I approach it. It's a little bit slightly maybe longer of a sales cycle, just because you're not there day one to sell them anything. And I think if you take that approach, you wind up getting more value out of them long term, because then you're a trusted partner and not just somebody trying to sell them something.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And if you don't mind, can you dig into your sales process a little bit? So, you know, let's say you have a call with somebody, they're XYZ position at a bank or a hospital, and they're like, yeah, this is interesting. You know, I'll take some time with Theresa. What happens then on that first call, second, third,
close? Yeah. So the first call is just me, because I don't want to overwhelm them. Like, here's my posse, you know, like all of that. So it's just me. First call, and it's really, and I set it up for them. Like I say, you know, typically I just want to get to know you, give you the opportunity to get to know me and my agency a little bit, learn about what your needs are. And then, you know, if it makes sense for us to continue talking, we can. And they're like, great. So then I just kind of go into my spiel about the agency and our services and collect as much information as I can about not just the company they work for, but really what their job is, right? Because part of the sales process is trying to help that new customer look like a rock star or whatever it is that their job is. I try not to leave any conversation without any next step. So in a perfect conversation one, I'm leaving that call having introduced them to a couple of the services that my agency does that we've already determined make sense for them or is a need for them on that call. And then highlight what next steps are going to be. Ideally, next steps are a follow-up conversation that includes at least one other person from my agency. I select that person just based off the conversation that I've had with the client, right? They could say, you know, their website is horrible, doesn't reflect who they are today and where the business is going. So that allows me to understand who I need to invite into the conversation next. I always do a follow-up email just so that they have, you know, contact. They have a capabilities deck so that if they want to share it with someone internally, because that is also something really important, that you're lucky if you're talking to the ultimate decision maker, but most of the time you have a couple people who need to make the decision. So you want to give them all the information they need to share and not have them have to recreate everything you talked about on the phone. So I kind of type it up nice so that they have it and all they have to do is forward it to the people it makes sense to. And then I take care of all the follow-up and attempting to set up that following meeting. In that second meeting, it's me plus whoever makes sense from my team and whoever might make sense from the opposite side as well, because sometimes they also go, oh, and I'm going to invite this person and this person. We expand the conversation to introductions of the team and make sure that everyone's caught up on what the first conversation was, collect even more information, and then again, try hard to come out of that second conversation with next steps. What are our next steps? In a perfect world, the next steps are us presenting some kind of plan or strategy against the topic or the question at hand or the issue that they're trying to solve that we've collected. It's like, okay, well, let us put our brains together. Let us figure out how we would strategically attack that. And then we'll come back to you in a couple weeks and present what that could look like. And then if you like it, we can say, okay, we'll move forward and we'll create a scope of work from that and put a budget against it. So that's the third meeting, is us presenting. Hopefully at the end of that third meeting, where everyone's heads are nodding and they're like, this is fantastic. Go ahead and now write this up as a scope of work and put a dollar amount against it. And then we can figure out if that works, or we're getting them to at least give us a range of some kind of dollar amount that makes sense. By the time the scope of work is going out, I am 90% of the way out of the conversation. And I have handed that baton over to who their main contact, or for now, that phase of getting them onboarded is going to be. And a lot of the time, that's our executive vice president, director of accounts, which is Kristen. So she'll take them and create the scope of work or the contract and make sure that we're in alignment, and then onboard them. We introduce even more members of the team. And then at that point, they should be a client and we're off to the races. And then I'm back at the beginning of the sales cycle with a different, you know, person.
Yeah, it makes sense. And thanks so much for that. And just a couple of follow-up questions there. I think there's a lot of different schools of thought on this, but when do you talk about money? Are you talking about money in the first call? If they press you, are you answering questions about scope? What's your thought on that?
I never talk about money on the first call, unless they bring it up. Now, I'm not afraid to talk about money, but I think that if you, as the salesperson who's trying to win new business, talks about money on the first call, it could potentially turn some people off. And I found, honestly, the more money a client has to spend, it might actually turn them off more that you're so focused on money. Because in their minds, they're like, I can afford whatever it is that I want to do. I'm here to make sure that you're the right person for me to do this business with, not if you're the cheapest or if you're this or if you're that. So people who have money, and this is true business personal, your decision-making isn't based off money. Your decision-making is based off other things because you have the resources to pay what you think is a fair price to pay. You're making decisions based off a lot of other factors. Do I like this person? Are they qualified? Can I trust them with my business? Are they going to do a good job? Is their team going to keep the balls in the air? Are they going to drop them? Those are how folks and clients who have resources are making decisions. So when it comes time to cost, you know, obviously do your research, but when it comes time to put a price tag on it, as long as the price tag is in alignment with the actual work that you're doing, and it's a fair one based on, you know, everyone's definition of fair, I don't get much, you know, pushback on costs by that time, because we've already established the ability is there, the trust factor is there. You have a team of folks, you know, it's not just me. I have 17 people behind me, you know, so it's, you know, bringing up money, unless they're like, so how do you guys, how do you get paid? Like, that's the question that sometimes people ask in the first meeting. And I'm happy. And actually it's a good sign when they ask that, because they're thinking, well, how does this person walk away with money? Because obviously we're all, you know, we all have to work and we all have to get paid. And I don't even speak dollar amounts in that case. I just talk about how the agency is compensated, whether it's on a fee or commission or retainer or whatever it might be. Like, these are our options. And based on where we go, you know, we can break it down that way. But, you know, specific dollar amounts come up later.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And one more follow-up to that process is, I think a lot of the times agencies we talk to get kind of jammed up by having to defer to their prospects process, right? And this plays out a lot with, you know, RFP, dog and pony shows. Hey, here's what we need you to do. You know, you're going to come here on these days and pitch and all that. And it sounds like you guys have a really well thought out, deliberate process between, you know, three or four conversations. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Like, how much are you, you know, pushing to get all the decision makers on call two or three? When are you holding your ground versus deferring? I know that's kind of a hard question, but we'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Honestly, we're still at a phase as a business from a size perspective, and the fact that, you know, the owner is still running the new business process, that we can be flexible with that. I don't push potential new clients too hard to bend to our process, right? Mainly because I think our process is a strategic, smart, if everything is working the way that it should be working, the clients, it feels good to them too. So if they are the perfect client, which is like they have a need, we are in alignment personally and professionally, and time is important to them. Like, they don't want to waste time. If all of those things are lined up, then the sales process that I just outlined works well for them too. And in some cases, people are like, where are we on that? Like, you know, they're pinging us to say, hey, where's that contract or where's that scope? Because they have something that's super time sensitive that needs to happen. So, yeah, that's how I approach it. We haven't hit the space yet where I'm like, you know, we're not having this meeting unless such and such is in the meeting. I could see that becoming a thing, but that's only become something for us to deal with, quite honestly, once clients have become clients, because then you start to see who, no matter who folks' titles are, sometimes you start to understand your client's flow of who needs to be in the room when we're presenting something for it to have the best case scenario of getting approved. Because then once you're working together, it's like creative approval process, media plan approval, asset approval. There's all these approvals that need to happen once you're a client. And if the right person's not in the room, that could delay a whole campaign launch by weeks. So that's when we push hard for the right folks in the right room.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it sounds like a situation where there's lots of judgment calls that have to be made. And there's not just this one size fits all model some of the time. And with that, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, what have you seen in terms of results of working with us? How have these campaigns panned out for what you can and are willing to talk about?
Yeah. Well, high level, I'll just say I've been really happy with it. I think it's a we've closed one new client with two more that are looking really promising. And that's, like I said, in a 6-7 month period. And it really, honestly, it just boils down to the strategy behind the outreach, right? And then, to be fair, like, to give myself and my team some credit, managing and running this new business process really well, right? Because you could collect leads all day, which is what your team is good at. But if my team wasn't good at converting leads into, you know, relationships and then therefore business, then it wouldn't be a good investment on my side, right? So I think both things are super important. And then it's just maintaining that relationship. You know, everybody has a different way of maintaining relationships with prospective clients. Working with you guys has inspired me to try, I haven't had time yet, but try to create like an email list of the folks that I've talked to that maybe it's not going to turn into something today, but has the potential to turn into something tomorrow. And just figure out fun, RLM specific ways to stay in front of them from a content perspective. So that maybe down the road that turns into something and it doesn't turn into a dry relationship. So yeah, I've been happy and it's been a good investment on my part. And it is that too. And agency, just business owners in general understand that you have to invest in your business for it to grow. And so 2020 and 2021 have been major investment years for us, both from a sales perspective for new business, but also from a talent perspective, which costs money to manage all this, you know, potential and current new business. So, but it's worth it because like anything else, if you invest smart, you wind up making money off of your investment. And that's what's happening.
Awesome. Frieza, thanks so much for that. Appreciate it. I'm glad to hear it. And with that kind of getting towards the end of our time, what's keeping you excited? Like, what are you looking forward to either at RLM or in life in general at this point?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because yes, all of the success and growth and progress that I'm experiencing at the agency is really great. And what makes me excited about it even more is that it frees me up to kind of concentrate on some of these other things that I have and love just as much as advertising, because I have a production company that I started a few years back that allows me to pour my creative energy into as a writer, as a producer, as a director. And so I'm writing now my second book, and I am in the process of creating another television show based on my first book, Love, Sex, and Friendship, in no particular order. So I am, with all of this, you know, setting my ad agency up to be its own, like, fully grown woman all by herself. With that, just like parenthood, you know, comes free time again. You're like, oh my God, my kid is not three anymore. She doesn't need me to, like, make her meals and remind her to go to the bathroom. I can now treat her like she's 18 because she is. And then that allows me to go, you know, do these other things that quite honestly will be my next phase of career path. Like, you know, once I am just the owner of RLM, and I don't know when that will be, but when I just get to own this company and not have to run it day to day, I'll be spending my time and my days creating content that my production company will put out.
Yeah. And that sounds like a really smart thing to do. I think a lot of founders either get their businesses off their plates or sell them or whatever. And then you're like, I'll figure it out later, figure out what I'm going to do with 24 hours after that. Yeah. So good on you for figuring it out. And anything you can, that's super interesting. So what's it like? I mean, just real quick, towards the end, what's it like producing a show nowadays? What do you have to go through to do that?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's funny because the first show I made, this is like 3 years ago now, was a reality show called PR Girl. And now that the last season from 2 years ago lives on Amazon and Plex and Tubi. But that filming is very different because you're dealing with non-actors, right? These are real people. Whose their work and their lives are the main topic of the show. So we're navigating our film schedule based on the real lives of these three different women that we feature on the show. Luckily we wrapped that and that was done about a year before COVID. and then met all of the requirements for these streaming platforms and was able to put the full season on these platforms. And then because people loved it and all that, they were like, oh, we need to do another season. And then COVID hit. And I was like, guys, obviously we can't just be roaming around with strangers. And like, first of all, there's nothing going on. It's COVID. So that was, we actually pivoted to like a digital talk show for early on in 2020. We were doing like Zoom conversations and I creatively kind of mashed these videos together and we put some episodes out, just helping folks understand what we were living through, like just talking about COVID, working from home, navigating your career. What if you just started a job and COVID happened, you know, like all of that stuff. But now with me getting into the scripted space, the pre-production phase is way longer. Like, you know, just to pull together the pitch materials to present to a network, who would ultimately be the ones financing the production of a scripted television show, has taken me and my show creator partner a whole year. Like so basically all of COVID, we've been taking my book and turning it into pitch materials for what will ultimately hopefully be my next television show that we make. So the timing has worked out great because now almost everyone I know is vaccinated and I am fully back into the world. And so I am now pivoting to, okay, here's what I've been working on during COVID in my spare time. And here's, you know, trying to set up meetings and get the show idea in front of the right people. So that, you know, when that happens, you know, in a perfect world, maybe that's next year. Arguably we all are in a way different spot, right? And COVID is not a thing that's at all running our lives and we're kind of back to normal and can shoot things like regular people. And it would be my first scripted show experience. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. And if you haven't thought about it or don't want to talk about it, no worries. But do you know who you'd want to play you, assuming it's fictional?
Well, I have like secret aspirations of who that would be. I should just put it out there so that maybe it would happen. Like when people ask me that, I go, Zendaya would be the perfect person to play Farisa at 25, 26 years old, because she is smart. She's sharp-witted. She's beautiful. And she's a great actress. And she's it. Like, she's it right now. She's an it girl. And she's been doing this for a long time. I can watch her on Disney with my kids from back in the day, all the way through, like, you know, Malcolm and Marie on Netflix. And like, she's just spectacular. So yeah. I don't know her, but maybe, you know, from my mouth to God's ears.
Right. Exactly. It makes a lot of sense. Hopefully we'll get you back on again to talk about the show if you have time and you're not extraordinarily busy and famous at that point. So So Farisa, how can people, you know, follow what you're up to, get in touch and so on?
Yeah. Well, I'm on all the socials minus Twitter, cause I don't have time to write for free. So Farisa Knox is my handle everywhere on Instagram, LinkedIn and Facebook.
Awesome. Farisa, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks again for listening to the Digital Agency Growth Podcast. Again, today's episode is sponsored by our company, Sales Schema. We are a fractional new business team for growth-focused boutique agencies and related marketing service companies. But even if you're not at the point of hiring us yet, I still really want to do you solid by giving you access for free, by the way, to our latest recorded video training. And that is titled Relationship Driven New Business at Scale, emphasis on at scale. And basically, this is how we secure around 5 to 20 weekly brand agency relationships for each one of our clients using tasteful email outreach centered on personal and or business commonalities that our clients share with the people they're reaching out to. So a few things that we cover the two big shifts that have informed this big strategy shift, and why we think you should rethink the way that you are doing new business. Most likely it's your agency. We talk about dozens of specific commonalities that we use to build relationships between our clients and brand side decision makers. We go over a simple, manageable follow-up process that you or your team can use, even if you're busy, even if you're in a mixed sales client service role. And we actually go over specific copy examples that you can use to get inspired and build your own campaigns. So if you'd like to get access to this roughly 30-minute video training, you can do that by going to salesschema.com/relationships. Again, that's salesschema.com/relationships, plural. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to catching you on the next episode of the Digital Agency Growth Podcast.